Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VCpreneur podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I am your host Digjay, and today I have with me Dimant Parekh, founder and CEO at The Better India, which is Asia's largest impact content platform, and The Better Home, India's first sustainability-focused subscription product company. Prior to becoming a founder, Dimant worked in various product roles at firms like Intuit, Hopers.com, and is considered to be one of the top product mentors for startups in India. In this episode, Dimant talks about his journey building Asia's largest content platform for impact, his learnings from the 0-1 phase at The Better India, importance of developing deep customer relationships early on in the startup's journey, leveraging community to build a strong consumer brand, making the shift from content to commerce powered by the community, and his fundraising experience at The Better India. I had a great time chatting with Dimant, and I hope you enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's dive in and find out what Dimant has to share. Welcome, Dimant. Welcome to the VCpreneur podcast. Very excited to have you with us today. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Digjay. Really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. It's our pleasure. And for the benefit of our listeners, let's start off by a brief introduction about you and what Better India is doing today.
Right. My name is Dimant Parekh. I run the platform called The Better India. The Better India is Asia's largest content platform that uses the power of content and community to drive large-scale impact. We reach out to over 100 million people every month now. And, our stories have led to massive scale impact across the country. We've managed to bring water and sanitation in villages. We've helped urban slum schools get funded. We've helped farmers come out of poverty. Really thousands and thousands of case studies out there of change that we were able to bring in, or I would say we were able to catalyze using the power of stories with the community we have. That's what the Better India does. And, very recently we've started the Better Home, which is basically trying to build India's largest sustainable FMCG brand as we try and drive conscious consumption across the country.
Awesome. And, if I were to take you back, at the beginning, tell us what led you to start the Better India in the first place? And what was the problem statement that you wanted to solve at the time?
Yeah, to kind of understand that, you'll have to go all the way to where I think when I was in business school way back in 2007, is when I met a bunch of people who came from the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Until then, I was working at a large tech company, and then I came into B school, and then I realized that there were people who had built some fantastic stuff on their own, and then they had come to business school. And that really changed my perspective of what I wanted to do post business school. So I did not take up any of those corporate jobs, which are usually what you do after business school, and joined a startup back then. And well, startups back in 2007, 2008 were like the early sort of internet companies being set up, right? And the first one I kind of went in was this company called Ibibo, which eventually, of course, became Go Ibibo. But back then, we were really trying to build a lot of other products on the internet, like social media, blogging, music streaming, whole bunch of things. And that was really my first exposure to the internet. But I think somewhere that the thought struck that here was this massive opportunity to be able to leverage the internet to build something huge, right? And I think everyone was trying to build, like, you started seeing e-commerce, you started seeing travel, you started seeing social media, all of that. And as I kind of continued working through different startups, one thought that kind of came up for both Anuradha, who's my co-founder, and me, was that how could you leverage this internet to build something which is a for-profit, large-scale impact kind of a company? Like, I mean, that should also be feasible. And both of us, for us, impact is kind of very dear to, what we wanted to do, is something that we really believe in. And we started spending more time around this. So our first hypothesis was that if you want to drive large-scale impact, you need to build a community of people around. Like, once you build a community of people, you can mobilize that community for various causes. And then you start thinking about how do you build a community? And how do you build a community that's very loyal and strong and believes in your vision? And the answer to that for us was that the power of stories is what will bring people together. And then we started, again, thinking about what do we mean by these stories? What are these stories? And the big gap that existed back then was that no one was really documenting stuff that's working in the country. on one end of the spectrum, you had traditional media, which is really talking about what's broken in the country. And that is, of course, extremely crucial as a role that it plays, which is, you know, you can only fix something if you know it's broken, right? So that part was being handled really well. But on the other end of the spectrum, there was absolutely nobody talking about what's working. And we felt that it's equally important to talk about this, because that is when ideas can go across from communities to states to Pan India, so that different people can then replicate these solutions and make change happen, right? And that is how we struck upon the idea of the fact that the Better India would kind of focus on a solutions-oriented kind of content. So really talk about someone faced a problem, what was the solution that person implemented, what was the impact of it, and how did they go about it? And I think that was really the broad way in which we went about it. And we started putting these stories out. And what was incredible to see is that even with a few hundred people reading this content that we were putting, people would actually go meet the protagonist that we've written about, donate money, donate time. And it just started happening like weeks after, you know, we started just blogging. It was just a blog, by the way. It wasn't charted out to be a large venture. The idea was that, is there something that can be built? And as we kind of started these stories out there, slowly people started writing back to us as to how some story changed their life, how someone we featured would write back to us saying, hey, because of this thing, you know, we've got so much recognition and money. And that's when we realized that this is a big opportunity for us to get in and really scale this up and see what's the kind of impact we can bring about. So I think that's really the journey with which we got there.
Right. Awesome. So, I mean, it started off as an experiment and something, you know, which you were just passionate about and wanted to build something. But along the way, you identified, you know, that these are the 2-3 drivers that can, you know, help you scale this business. And you kind of chanced upon that to, you know, to scale the business, which is the Better India today. But if you could describe the 0-1 journey, what were the key learnings and takeaways for you, you know, from that phase? And this is important because a lot of startups, you know, failed during that phase because trying to validate their product and establish, you know, product market fit. But there's a learning for startups, you know, if they kind of look at the companies which are mature enough today and look at what they did right in their 0-1 phase.
That's a good question. And it's a very tough question to answer. Look, I think the whole 0-1 is, I know there's the Peter Thiel book and this, you know, there are all frameworks being built around how to build, go from 0-1. I think the reality is that if you really want to build something from 0-1, you need to be sure that you have 10 years with you to go from 0-1. It does not happen in 3 years, 2 years, 1 year. And the stuff that you read of companies that have done it in 1 or 2 years or 3 years are the outliers, like complete outliers. And you cannot base your journey or even forecast your journey based on that. So take a more pragmatic view. Now, if 0-1 is going to take you 10 years, right? You have to pick something that you are so passionate about that even if it takes 20, 25 years, a quarter of your life, you would be happy doing it every single day. If it's an area or a subject that you don't feel as passionate about, but you're really excited, hey, the market is there, so we should get in, I don't think you will survive that 10-year horizon, right? It's extremely hard because it's not something you feel strong about. And I think that is the core essence of how a company kind of either scales or just falls apart. Because if you're so passionate about bringing this change or making this change happen, you will figure out all possible ways to kind of get there. But if it's just a fleeting interest in a sector that is booming and getting a lot of funding, trust me, it's not going to last beyond 2 years, 3 years. And so to navigate all of that, there has to be something else that keeps you alive. And that has to be the passion for that sector or that subject that you're going behind. So yeah, I think it has a lot to do with what you believe in and what you really want. And you're okay with waking up every morning and saying, even if I'm not making money, but I need to see this change or I need to be able to drive this change. And I think that's what keeps people going. And then it's really the whole power of compounding kicks in. The more you keep doing it, the better you get at it. And the better you get at it compared to the competition, and eventually you get to a point where it becomes crystal clear to you, but most others don't see it, right? And they can't figure out how could you kind of do this. But it's just the power of compounding, which is just starting to happen. And it starts happening in the 6th year or the 7th year, not in the 3rd year or the 4th year. And I think that endurance is really needed.
No, absolutely. And, you know, what were some fundamental challenges, you know, that you had to face in that early, you know, 1 to 2 years of your journey when you just started out? What was your key takeaway from that, you know, phase of your journey?
Look, I think for us, the biggest challenge was that something like this did not exist before. If we were starting something in the e-commerce space or social media or something, I think everyone would have understood. So we were entering a space From background, we had no clue how to do content or, you know, stories and stuff. Secondly, the ecosystem wasn't there in terms of understanding what are we building. But the one person who got it was our reader. The reader loved what we were doing. And the reader would come back every day, every week, write to us, engage with us and all of that. So clearly we were making something, but the reader acceptance was very high. People were just starting to gravitate to this and say, oh, this is so refreshing. Our newspapers and our television channels have nothing else to talk about, but we've now started including you guys in our diet of consumption. And I think that was crucial for us. I think we got that right. But extremely hard to get, let's say, brands to come in and say, hey, you know what, you need to advertise here or you need to sponsor some of the stuff here. So monetization was extremely hard because this is something that people didn't understand. And we had this constraint put on ourselves that we will not just do PR for brands. Brands have to come with us and co-create content around specific causes, which we believed in. You know, so that was a whole new model we were trying to push. And then, of course, you had investors probably didn't understand, like, how could there be a market for this? I still remember talking to, you know, because we were just new into the space, I started talking to a lot of the senior folks and editors at traditional newspapers and magazines and stuff. And every single person told us that there is no market for this. There is no readership. There is nothing to be built here. So, you know, don't bother. But on the other hand, here we were seeing week on week, people coming back, writing to us, saying how transformational this was. So there was this whole disconnect there. And I think at one point we said, okay, let's take this leap of faith and kind of do it because we're seeing the right signals from the ground. So I think the hardest decision was to fully commit ourselves to this at one point and say, either you build it or you don't. There's no sort of two way about it. And in a sector where other than your user, nobody else kind of really got what we were doing. So it became doubly hard to convince people to do stuff for us. I think that was really hard, but slowly chipping away and you start getting a few successes and then you start kind of showing those successes. Then you get more people kind of joining the movement. And I think that's really how the whole scale up happened from when we started to where we are today.
No, awesome. And it's very interesting because in the traditional sense, what an investor or what someone who's, you know, trying to size the market would look at is, you know, are users interested? Are users adopting this? And for you, no one could see that because there was no one doing it before you. And because you were so close to the customer and, you know, very importantly, you were listening to them clearly is probably what gave you that conviction. And I think that's a very good lesson for a lot of founders who are working on something which doesn't have a market today, but can take this approach to expand on that market and, you know, build that traction to form a new market and scale the company. Dhiman, I want to, you know, shift gears here and talk about the shift from content to commerce. And, you know, as you scaled up your company, tell us what led you to foray into e-commerce and what were the supporting factors that helped you, you know, validate that decision and take that call?
Yeah. So, Tanjay, you know, for that, you go back to the larger vision we always had even before we started the Better India. And that question was, how do you leverage the internet to drive large-scale impact? We'd managed to do that by building a community and a content play so far. So the Better India kind of grew this community and we had driven large-scale impact across various sectors. And so we were very clear that once you have a community, there are different ways in which you could build vertical businesses on top of this community, right? And we were kind of really thinking about what do we build on top of this? And I'm talking about like mid-2018, where the community had kind of grown sizable amount. And we were toying with various ideas in terms of what do we build on top. Now, one very interesting thing started happening is that of all the content that we were putting out, we started slowly seeing around 2018 mid, we started seeing that content around sustainability, content around climate change, content around natural products, you know, we would feature small businesses making some natural products. All that kind of content started getting consistently more engagement and readership. Like, and I mean like significantly more, I would like say 60, 70% more. And that was not happening before that. So you were starting to see some sort of a shift happen in terms of readership preferences. So we started digging deeper. We started putting out more content and seeing, you know, was that just one off? And we started seeing clearly people are gravitating towards this. People want to have conversations around this. And we then decided to actually have conversations with our readers. So, you know, we would set out polls, we would have emails. We in fact even started calling people to our office once every 2 weeks. And really started digging deeper to understand who are these guys. And one thing started emerging, that there was this massive shift happening where people were starting to prioritize wellness, hygiene, And people were becoming conscious in terms of what they were doing to themselves and to the planet, right? So you started seeing that shift happen in personal care. You were starting to see that shift happen in food. And suddenly there's this whole thing about organic food or food, sustainable food, all of that. So somewhere we realized that, A, there's a big opportunity for us to kind of bring sustainability or access to sustainability to our readers. I think we were thinking more about that from that perspective. And it became very clear when we met all our readers. There was this huge need for people to have a brand or access to these kind of products. And so we decided that, okay, there are a whole bunch of small businesses who actually make these products. And why don't we just, you know, get them in front of the audience? And that was the initial thought. So we actually built a marketplace because we also wanted to help small businesses from a livelihood perspective. So access to market.
Yep.
And access to sustainability for the consumers, right? So we got all of these guys together. And it was amazing to see people, you know, buying products from these small businesses. And I think as we started scaling up, one big realization happened to us that, you know, we at one point we had almost about, I think, close to 1,000 sellers, small businesses on the supply side. And as the demand started going up, a lot of the small businesses were not able to keep up with the demand because of supply chain issues, capital issues, and all of that. And for us, it became operationally very tough to kind of manage it at a scale of multiplied by 1,000, right? It's not just one supplier, but like 1,000 suppliers and stuff. So that's when we realized that I think the way for us to be able to scale was going to be if we actually start owning the entire supply chain, right from the products that we create, where we get them manufactured, the logistics, the warehouse, and all of that. And that's when we decided that we need to pick a category and go deep rather than go horizontal the way we were trying to do. So very quickly, we sized the opportunity and we realized that home care has not seen any disruption. You know, if I ask you to name a toilet cleaner other than a Harpic, this, you know, you'd struggle to come up with a name. And to me, that was astonishing that because here's a big opportunity which no one has looked at. And from a sustainability perspective, all the effluent waste that is getting generated in our cities, a good chunk of it is coming from domestic use when we wash our clothes and we wash our dishes and we wash our, you know, homes. So we said, hey, this is really where we could actually get in. It's a big opportunity and there's a big opportunity for impact. If we can give more clean, sustainable products, it can drive a huge change. And that is how the Better Home got conceptualized. And our products are non-toxic and 100% biodegradable. We launched with 4 products, a floor cleaner, a toilet cleaner, a laundry wash, and a dishwash. In fact, just 2 days ago, we've launched 3 more products. And it was phenomenal to see this. We launched this in the middle of the pandemic, by the way. I think we went live in the middle of May. So the hypothesis was that if we want to make it sustainable, it's not just the product, but it should also be the process and the mechanism and the supply chain that we could make it more sustainable. So we came up with this whole subscription program. The first kit that you get comes in plastic bottles, but which are meant for long-term reuse. And all your subsequent subscription kits come in pouches. And then we run a take-back program where the pouches are come back to our warehouse and we work with local organizations to recycle them and upcycle them. So trying to build a whole circular economy.
Yeah.
And that was really loved by our readers who were already kind of big into sustainability. And now here was something that they could actually opt for. So yeah, that really was why and how we got into commerce. It was more about tying to that larger vision of how do you drive large-scale impact.
You already have content and you had built a community around it, a conscious community around your content. The only missing puzzle was bringing commerce to that. And what's beautiful is, you know, the power of community. You know, you were almost a distribution first company by then. You already had access to that community where you can, you know, you could probably launch anything that they were curious or were interested in reading about. So I think that's a good takeaway that, you know, if you build a good and strong community around your brand or around your product, there are ways where you can, you know, go and expand and, you know, launch new verticals. So to that point, my next question is, what should founders focus on to build a brand for their product and service? And what role does, you know, community play in establishing and strengthening that brand?
Okay, what should you focus on? I think getting your, what everyone talks as the product market fit, right?
Mm-hmm.
To me, product market fit is very fluid. I don't think that there is one sort of product market fit. I think that product market fit changes, especially in a digital world, it changes every 6 months because consumer behaviors are changing every 6 months. So I think what it is to get right is, I would say, constant deep connect with a small cohort of your customers, but making sure that they are super thrilled with the service that you have before you start thinking of expanding. And to give you specific examples, I still, you know, this is something I'm unable to do now, but when we started, we would put out a piece of content and we would get like a few emails I would make sure that I reply to those emails within 2 hours. That was a benchmark I'd kept for myself. And every single person who would get a reply would be super thrilled because they said, you know, nowhere we thought that a company email address put up on a footer in a website would ever get a response. So we would just kind of try our luck. And within 2 hours, you get a response, and that which is personal, because I would actually take the effort to write personally. I think that, and I did that consistently for like, I think 3-4 years, even as the volumes kind of continued to increase. To me, that was a very important aspect of building that direct connect with the customers. And from them, I was able to actually understand exactly what are they doing, who are they, what do they like, what do they not like, and how we should be shaping things around this thing. So I would definitely say having a very deep relationship with your customers, especially during the initial phases, is like just invaluable.
Yep.
They help you shape a lot. Look, there are always two schools of thought, right? One is that the customer doesn't know what the customer needs. So build it as per what you want, and the customer will then realize. The second is that, hey, the customer is a great source of information.
Yep.
I think your territory or your line of path should balance the two. There will always be things that they don't know, but there will always be things. There's a lot of trend that you can actually glean by just talking to people. So I would say first thing is to just get it right, that whatever you're putting out there, there is a significant traction on a repeatable basis from a core bunch of people who love your stuff that you're doing so much. And then the challenge becomes for you to figure out how do you keep adding layers and layers and layers and layers from that core so that it's sizable for you to run it as a business, right? Otherwise, it just remains a core sort of a project. I think that's one thing. I think community plays a huge role in any sort of business. Because look, at the end of the day, if you don't have a following for your company, there isn't going to be much that you can pull off. Fundamentally, you can start with a lot of cash in the bank. You can start with a lot of advertising blitz. You can do a crash and burn. But if the people who have got are not talking about you, then you're basically just on a steady decline, and you will not have much to show after your cash runs out. So really kind of building that community which rallies around your cause and does that not because you're paying them, but does that because they believe in you, I think that's a core thing to figure out. And it's supremely critical.
Yeah, right. And I think you've laid it out pretty well. You know, fundamentally, first, getting that wow factor to your initial customers helps you build that relationship in the first place. And, you know, that relationship helps you, you know, set the foundation to build a strong community around it. And like we discussed, you know, having a community, you can go and launch as many verticals as you want, as long as you are, you know, launching relevant products. So that's kind of a powerful way to, you know, build a moat around your business, and which we are clearly seeing with the Better India today. So Dhiman, you know, now you're managing two verticals, the Better India, the content side, as well as the Better Homes, which is the commerce side of things. You know, how do you approach this new dynamic and space out time in terms of, you know, day-to-day tasks that you have to do versus long-term strategic decision-making that you have to do for the business?
Yeah. Look, I mean, there are two ways, right? One is that, of course, you get to a reasonable size so you can hire people to do your day-to-day operational stuff, and you only get to do the growth and strategic stuff. The practical answer is that that's very tough to get to, because you always have stuff that has to be navigated. But it's also very easy to get sucked into day-to-day operations and feel that you're doing a lot of work, when in essence, it's the time you take off for thinking through the growth. That is what will add the biggest value to the growth of your company. So it's always a challenge. It's always a challenge, and it's very tempting to get into day-to-day operations. One of the things I used to do before was actually mark up calendar slots every week, which were dedicatedly kind of blocked out for me to think through some of the larger issues and larger challenges that the company could face 3 months later, 6 months later, and a year later. That was one very important aspect. The one sort of big insight I've had over the years is that, look, I mean, whatever plans you make, right, they will not go as per plan. And a lot of us, when we forecast, we say, okay, you know what, this is going to happen. And, you know, you have these Excel sheets and modeling done and all of that stuff. I think it's very important to factor in this whole thing called room for error. And that does not necessarily mean you have to be conservative in your approach on things, but that just basically means that I accept that there is going to be a lot of randomness which happens, which is outside your control. So we would always make sure that when we're forecasting, what are we going to do over the next 6 months or a year, start bringing in these sort of rooms for error and see that, okay, if this doesn't go, here's my backup plan, here's how I'm going to do it. But always making sure that I'm going to be able to navigate and keep moving forward, right? When you do only day-to-day operations, you kind of get stuck. And if you've not been able to create those sort of forecasts for the next 6 months or a year, it becomes extremely hard, because suddenly you will hit a point where you're like, oh man, okay, I didn't know that this happened. And then it's very tough to roll back, right? So I think very important, earmark 4 hours a week that is just dedicated to thinking through all the things that you think you can achieve, all the challenges that you think can come your way, and plan for those, or at least be aware of those, so that, you know, it helps your decision making a lot. So that's really one way I used to do it. Just put it down in your calendar so nobody can book it.
Right. Got it. Dimant, I want to, you know, switch gears and talk about the fundraising aspect now. And that's, you know, something which a lot of founders struggle to, you know, just time it in terms of, you know, when they want to raise, how much they want to raise, and what's the best time to, you know, go ahead and reach out to the investors. So in your case, you know, what were you trying to look for in those investors? And if there were any investor rejections that you had to face early on?
Yeah. Okay. So like I said, the Better India was trying to do something which wasn't done before. And we actually bootstrapped it for the longest period of time. And it was when we hit a wall in terms of really having depleted all our savings, we decided that we had to raise some capital. So I would say the first round of the Better India's funding was largely due to us having no choice. So I did meet a lot of early stage investors back then. And I think we would largely get asked two questions, right? One is that, has it been done before? Is there something like this in the US? Or has someone kind of pulled it off? For which obviously we had no answers, and there was nothing like this before, even in the Indian market. So we said no. Then they're like, okay, have you talked to people from the industry? And I said, yes. And they've all said that this is not going to work, but we think it will work. So we should, you know, raise some money. And I think it was almost a year of meeting a lot of people and almost everyone saying no. And then we happened to chance upon a angel network who comprised of angel investors who would invest in impact kind of focused companies. Now, what was interesting is that when I actually went to pitch to them, this whole group of angel investors, because they were investing in angel, they were investing in impact companies, turns out that they were subscribers of the Better India, because that's where they would find their source of social enterprises that they would look up at, right? And so suddenly I go there and turns out that a lot of them have actually been subscribers of our newsletter and stuff. And they knew the value of what we were doing. And they said, yes, absolutely, we should do this. And that's how we, you know, so a few of them came in from there. Then a few of my friends and family kind of chipped in and we closed that first round. So it was hard, especially hard because it was in a sector which nobody had seen. This was also a time when digital media consumption was not that high. I mean, it's not like today where practically all of our time is on mobile phones and we're consuming content. But this was back then, it wasn't the case. And so it was doubly hard. The second fundraise was more out of saying that, hey, we see this big opportunity and we need to kind of, you know, be able to capture this opportunity. And I think we met a few, but our failure rate was very low. And we were lucky to meet, you know, our current investors, and we kind of closed it. So they also believed in our vision equally, and we kind of managed to close it. So I think it's extremely hard, fundraising extremely hard in the early stages when you're just trying to kind of raise on an idea. So it's important there to find people who have experienced your idea, or who feel equally strongly about it. That's exactly what happened with us. These were people who had experienced our platform and had seen value in it and said, let's do this. So try and see if you can find people in the early stages, people who've used your product or at least something similar and can see that this thing, even if there is no precedence for an idea like this. I think the second and the subsequent rounds then can become a lot easier if you're able to show growth. And people will see that opportunity, because by then you would have showed it that, hey, there is something here to build.
Right. And was there a specific criteria in that second phase of fundraising? Because at that point, you had numbers to show, you already had traction. So in terms of criteria for investors that you wanted to raise the funds from?
Yeah, I think two criteria, right? One is that you feel personally sort of relatable to the person, or you can hold a conversation, and would you love having lunch with that person? I think it might seem kind of frivolous, but the fact is that, you know, once you get an investor and then you have that person on your board, and then you have, you're spending a lot of time together. So I think it was important. I had attended a lot of talks of various investors and stuff, various places, and so got to know some of them and how they think. The second thing, of course, which is important, is the combined belief in terms of what we were trying to build, right? I think a strong conviction in the fact that, A, there is an opportunity that we should go after, and B, that this is the team that can really kind of execute it. I think these two criteria were very important. Of course, after that, you also look at, you know, what are the portfolio companies they have and what have they been doing? And then you talk to other portfolio companies and get some feedback and all of that. But more importantly, I think that conviction that this is the opportunity, like someone has to be equally convinced about it.
Yeah, Yeah. So, you know, what are the specific areas of business that you know, usually seek support and advice from your investors today?
Look, I think one is connections.
Very important.
Opening up the doors in different, you know, different sectors where you don't have connections or you want to kind of learn from other sectors. That helps a lot. And I would say a lot of things that we don't have experience in. So to give you an example, for instance, how do you structure your org? Like, what is a good org structure when you have so many moving parts because you have so many sectors, so many divisions and all? What's the best way so that the structure works well? That's an important aspect, which, you know, because they've done it in different portfolio companies who've gone from zero to massive scale and IPO and all of that. So you get a lot of good understanding from there. We've been able to use their help in interviewing a lot of our senior candidates. And because they are outside the company, they're able to get a very good view in terms of where this person will add value and not add value. So it's been fantastic to get help on hiring, right, from our investors. So yeah, I'd say a whole bunch of gaps that exist within us where we don't know, we don't have the skill set, we've been always able to kind of bank on them and get that help.
Dhiman, this has been amazing, and you know, we would have loved to go on, but just in the interest of time, we'll switch to our final segment, which is the rapid fire round. You know, I'll shoot some questions and hope to get your immediate thoughts on the same.
Sure, sounds good. Let's do this.
Okay, first question. One thing that you would like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem?
I think access to knowledge. It's still very in silos. It's in podcasts like yours, it's in blogs, it's in tweets, it's just not out there.
Agreed.
And by access to knowledge, I just don't mean like documented stuff, right? I really think a lot more collaboration needs to happen between people. It's still in silos. And maybe it's a journey that'll still take time to mature. But just having collaboration between all startups, just being so open to sharing data and information.
Yeah.
I would just love that transparency to kick in. People to be open about their successes and their failures. I think it's so crucial. Today, it's very skewed towards us celebrating those unicorns and there is nothing else at the end, right? So there's one big deadbeat failure or there's one sort of a $10 billion company. And in the middle is where all of us kind of thrive, is just not spoken about. So I think just collaboration between people is so important.
No, absolutely with you on that. And hopefully we'll see that, you know, with the excitement and the buzz around the ecosystem now, especially as we, you know, go into this new decade.
Yeah.
Next question. If you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
that's a good one. I think I would give a talk on why it's important for everyone to start running long distance.
Uh-huh.
You know, I come from a background which... with zero emphasis on sports or any sort of physical activity. And I picked this up in my late 20s, early 30s. And it's been truly transformational for me. And it just amazes me why enough people don't do it even now. And I would love to just talk about A, how transformational it is, how therapeutic it is, how it kind of really starts changing your perspective on things. And second, I'd love to kind of extend that to help people to get started very easily. So yeah, I think my TED talk would be on long distance running.
Awesome. Awesome. Look forward to that, you know, whenever that is out. Last question, VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to.
I think there are lots. There are lots. And quite a few of them are people I know as friends. I definitely would talk about a whole bunch of them, actually. So it's been amazing to interact whenever I get to interact with Kaval of Fireside, always so knowledgeable and insightful on things. There would also be Sandeep Farias, who's from Elevar, who's an investor in us. It's been fantastic in terms of having the larger picture being, you know, every time kind of getting us to start thinking about that. There are two of my friends who've started a very interesting VC fund called Special Invest, which is doing some fantastic stuff in space tech and, you know, deep tech. Arjun Rao and Vishesh, I'm just in awe of what they're trying to do in the space. So love that. There's Nitin Sharma erstwhile with First Principles, and just recently he's moved to Antler. He's been an advisor to us also, and I think a great person to have in the startup ecosystem. Yeah, I think this is so many people out there. It's really very hard to pick. My list can go on for hours, actually.
And it's funny, you know, we've already had Vishesh on the show and Nitin as well.
Oh.
You know, I agree to you that, you know, all of them have great insights and very open to share what they're going through and just making that playbook open, which is very important. So, Dhiman, thanks so much for doing this. really appreciate the time you've taken out. Any last thoughts for, you know, aspiring and current founders who are listening to this episode?
Yeah, I think just understand that, you know, a lot of outcomes that happen may or may not be in your control, and it's perfectly fine. All of us are kind of functions of both hard work and luck. And I think it's important to kind of acknowledge that you know, all the effort you put in, it's not necessarily your fault if things didn't go right. And a lot of us kind of berate ourselves and kind of take it upon ourselves. And I think that's being a bit too harsh. I think just take a step back and enjoy the privilege to be able to build something. And that's such a lovely thing that you get to build something. And I think that experience alone is more valuable than any other metric that the world puts on you. So I think I just want to lay it out saying, you know, just build for the joy of building, and I think you'll love it.
Beautiful, Deepan. You know, it's been amazing having you on the show. Would have loved to, you know, keep continuing this conversation, but we'll leave it for the next time when we have you on the show. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Digjay. It was a pleasure too. Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guest know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.